Everyone learns a language for different reasons. Maybe you want to watch K-dramas without subtitles or talk with family members in their native language. Your life is unique. Your language learning should be too. Rosetta Stone, the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years, just launched Rosetta Stone Sapphire, a new app that combines its proven immersion method with the latest innovation and technology to help you learn faster, personalize your lessons, and have more fun along the way. Most language apps teach the same generic topics. Sapphire helps you focus on what you actually want to talk about, whether that's travel, family, work, or your favorite hobbies. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. You'll get unlimited access to all 25 Rosetta Stone languages, plus all the new Sapphire learning tools. Visit rosettastone.com/audio to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/audio and start learning a language for real.
Basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-court stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fadeaway.
Yes! Giants for the win. Bang!
James puts up the three.
Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining.
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast, and we're recording this less than 24 hours away from the 2026 NBA draft. And joining us, a very busy Mike Garcia. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on your busy night between us. You're going to be on Trudell's show on ESPN later, Alan's show a little bit later. After that, man, you've become a go-to guy for this, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm just really excited about this entire process.
Yes, likewise, likewise. And so we're going to get into it, go for about 30 minutes today. You know, we did that Parapods a couple of weeks ago, and thank you for that, where we went over a few names, and I've got a couple of other names to go through before that. But in today's pod, I'd kind of like to hear what's on your mind going into this last stretch right before the draft. Like, where are you at from a Lakers perspective as we head into tomorrow's draft?
So the things that are on my mind is all the stuff I've been reading lately, whether it's been Twitter or whatever articles it may be, is everything referring to Jaden Quaintance falling down to the Lakers pick. That actually has me by surprise because I'm thinking, well, if he's falling down to the Lakers pick, maybe there's something with that injury that I'm not aware of. I don't have access to medical reports or anything like that. And if teams were positive about his medical reports, why wouldn't they just take him earlier? Mm-hmm. So that's hence a surprise, right? So on top of that, there's this idea of, I recall our draft episode last year, and we talked about Adu Thiro, and I was aware of his knee injury, and I was debating between what it would be like to draft a rare archetype in Thiro, high motor, high athleticism, like still kind of figuring things out since he's growing into his body and all this other stuff, figuring out who he is as a basketball player, really. And that versus a player that I had ranked 17th on my personal board last year in Maxime Reyno. And there's this idea of, oh, we need immediate contribution right away. And I was more confident about Reyno doing that because I'm thinking, well, here's the 7-foot guy. I know he can space the floor. I know he can rebound. That's two things that'll keep him on the floor. I wouldn't expect him to make major decisions, but he can pass a little bit. Not the most dynamic defensive player, but he can contribute. A shift, a two. But it worked out for the Sacramento Kings, who ended up taking him. And then he ends up on the all-rookie second team. It's like, okay, well, that's a great outcome. And then here's Thiro, and we've seen the flashes all year long. And the thing that I've kind of kept, I guess, somewhat statistically to myself is, when does he enter the game and how soon until he gets a dunk, right? Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious because more than half the season, whether it's South Bay or in the NBA game, within 3 minutes, he's just going to get one.
Yep.
And I just don't know how. It's like, oh, offense, rebound, dunk. He's going to drive for one. He's out in transition, whatever else it might be. Then we end up seeing the motor, some defensive ability that we weren't kind of really anticipating. I knew he could hang, but I wasn't sure how disciplined he would be. And I think he had a like just flash the great sequence against Jaylen Brown for a little bit. It's like, oh, it's like that. Oh, okay. Well, This is a worthy risk, and I'm glad the Lakers ended up with Hero. And now it's, oh, maybe this is Jayden Clayton's now, and maybe we're willing to be patient, and maybe that is the best player available. And that's the idea of what best player available is. The definition changes all the time, right? It's like, oh, who can outplay their expectation, right? Whatever else it might be. So I like the idea of, oh, I think this is the best player that we can actually get, and then forget the timetable. So that's what I'm looking forward to with that whole thought process.
And then from the Reno perspective, could you give me like three guys that are projected in our 25 type of range, and we'll see if they keep the pick or move up or down, but that you think could contribute right away? Like, what are the guys that you think are readiest to step in and be able to do what Reno did for the Kings last year?
So we talked about the guys on the last draft pod, and there are two that are foremost that come to mind. One is Joshua Jefferson. The IQ is there. He's ready, executed on both ends of the floor with limited mistakes. He doesn't need to be a hub of an offense or run an offense. He just needs to make good decisions. And that sets a high floor on both ends of the floor. And then he doesn't get a lot of fouls. So the worst case scenario is, okay, maybe his shots don't drop early or something like that. But everything else, he contributes on the floor with rebounding, being timely with defense. I mean, the closeouts may be a little bit funky, but at least he knows who to close out to, right? That's timely. How to space the floor, passing to the right guy. All of those things absolutely matter. That's 1-2 shifts per game out of my mind. The second aspect is Taurus Reed Jr. Just NBA center size, right at 7 feet, 7'4" arms. You know what he's going to do. He's operated, once again, for UConn in more complicated schemes on offensive and defensive end. He knows he's a finisher. He knows he's a post player. He's hit, you know, backdoor cutters for layups and whatnot. He knows how to kick out to shooters when they're open, that whole kind of thing. Simple decisions, but things to be mindful of, because we didn't really get that out of the center position too much last year. And maybe that opens up the offense a little bit more. So also on the edge of being foul prone, but at the same time, the Lakers do need that physicality, that kind of size, and just versatility on both ends of the floor to stay on the floor in the first place. And he could provide that. A third player would be like Zubi Ejiofor. I think of the main four. And when I say the main four, that includes Ejiofor and Henry Vissar of the main group of guys that we've talked about. Ejiofor is kind of seen as this niche role player, switchable defensive center. He's a little bit smaller. It's not exactly too clear what he does on offense, where Taurus Reed Jr. is more of a post player. Ejiofor kind of operates. He's been at the corners, and then he makes a couple threes, but it's only high 20% behind the arc. He's operated at the elbows, and he's kind of a face-up guy. He'll make those passes too when he finds a cutter. Okay, great, but still not sure. And then he's not really a low post player at all. So it's kind of like, what does he do? So even if it's a specialized role, it's still an important one at the NBA level, because the Lakers have ran switching schemes defensively, and I prefer to have guys switch that are bigger and not just smalls all the time. And you need that size in the front court, preferably in the backcourt as well, but anywhere you can get it. And Ejiofor provides a defensive versatility. So those are the three guys I could think of that are most NBA ready right now.
And Jefferson, would you project him as a four on the NBA level?
I would.
Can he be a big, you think?
He is a little bit big. And I've thought about this just a little bit more, where what if he was kind of like Jay Crowder? We couldn't really define if Jay Crowder was a wing. He kind of defended the four, but he had his defensive moments. He was kind of a little bit known more as a defensive player coming out of college or whatever else it might be. And I was thinking, hey, that's a solid floor role player. And when Crowder was healthy, he was able to make some positive impact on the game. But Jefferson would do it more in terms of decision-making or whatever else it might be. So it's kind of that combo forward kind of stuck in between. But yes, I do see him more as a four.
Yeah, so along with Ejiofor and Reed, we're talking kind of bigger players in terms of the guys that are ready to play now in your projection. Is that right?
Yes, and it's, of course, my Laker bias is already looking at bigger players, but sure. It just so happens that the draft has kind of fallen that way where, oh, I think the best available players just happen to be bigs. So if that's the case, might as well take advantage of where, you know, the talent actually is.
Let's go to break here, come back, and I want to hear more of your thoughts on guys like Quaintance that you think could or maybe might drop.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So on Quaintance, you know, he's a 6'9", 6'10", big man, but with like a 7'5", wingspan, as you articulated last time. I was like, you know, you don't play basketball with the top of your head. You don't really look at a height anymore. It's and got great defensive instincts and timing, pretty good feet from what I've seen. Hasn't played a lot, and obviously he's coming off of that knee type of injury. Are there other guys that you could see in our range that are more on that end of the scale where, hey, it might take a little bit of time due to injury, like Adu or Quaintance, or they're a bit on the young side, not ready right away, but could be a great long-term play?
There's only one other player that comes to mind, and he's the only one that I've seen kind of fall to the Lakers pick or even be past it, which really surprises me. And as I mentioned before, we've talked about him in the prior pod, it's Ibuka Okori. And yeah. I'm wondering why he's falling that far, to be honest. And I think it's because there's just too many point guards in this draft that are happen to be lottery, and you can't just slot them all at number five. So, you know, about Okori, just a quick sum up. He's about 6 foot, 1.5 without shoes, 6'7" plus arms. I think he was 57% at the rim. That's part of the hesitance. But when I see the kind of contests he was shooting against, I'm thinking, no, he's fine. Like, if he's seeing all of the defensive pressure at the rim and he's handling all of the offense basically by himself as a creator, I'm good with that. Give me a 57% chance to make a shot any day of the week.
Yep.
Within the half court. So, and then kind of mid-40s long two, 35% three-point range. But it's the variety of shots that has me thinking he's a lottery-level player. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking the other point guards, like, what other edges do they have? Because I think of all the remaining ones, I mean, I'll just mention guys that won't slip to the Lakers pick, like Keen Wagler, Darius Acuff, LeBaron Filon, so and so on, and so on and so forth. These guys, you know, they're not all high-level defenders, or they're not the tier one top-level athletes, or, you know, they have their own issues as well, and they're all relatively the same size. It's not like Okori is too small. Okay, 186 pounds still makes me feel a little bit conscious about my weight still. Right. And believe me, if I was as quick and I could run as fast as Okori, I would burn off all my calories off too. But I have him projected as a top 10 pick. It wouldn't be the first time in an NBA draft where, oh, I've seen a guy that I've put in the lottery and he just happens to fall. Like Josh Hart fell into the late first round. I'm like, that's a lottery player. He's a 40% three-point shooter. He's a rebounder. He's a multi-champion for Villanova. What else does he do? And then he just happened to fall all the way down to late first. That's kind of what I'm looking for. And then it's the same idea with Dero. Like, well, maybe the skill isn't as refined because he's still trying to find out who he is. That's lottery level athleticism. That's lottery level motor. That's lottery level wing size. Oh, just get him. So that's kind of where I'm at with who could possibly slip down to the Lakers pick.
What do you say to the Laker fan that's like, there go the freaking Lakers again, adding another guard, another ball handler. We need front court players. We need centers and things like that. How could you possibly be looking at a guard, an on-ball guard with that pick?
I would bring up a roster construction philosophy question because I think about how the talent of the team dictates the style and then the system gets made afterward. So for example, if we're looking at the Warriors and their championships, I honestly can't recall the last time a championship team was built around two primary shooters. And then the Warriors just happen to implement, hey, well, we'll just have, you know, our center as a hub, and then we'll have these two guys work off the ball and use a lot of off-ball screen utilization. And next thing you know, they have a dynasty run, right? The closest I could think to that would be, what, the 72 Lakers with Wilt as a hub? And then you had Goodrich and West. And then they still both resemble triangle principles or whatever else it might be, but the talent of the team was already there. It's like, this is the best thing that we do. We do this better than everybody else in the league. This is the system that can optimize that. Let's go do that. What I see for the Lakers is we're a rim pressure team. we're really good at close two-point shooting, floater range, mid-range. We're good at all of that. In fact, we're so good that the three-point shot quality from Kennard and Rui is really great, and then they're shooting really high percentages, right? So Okori just emulates that all over again. Mm-hmm. And I think in the conversation we've had offline, but if they're going to be a pick-and-roll team, well, get a guy that can pick and roll.
Let's be the best team at that, exactly like you were saying with the Warriors. And you sort of have a guard at every size, assuming we retain Austin, like Luka, Austin, Okoro. That's three different versions of a killer pick and roll player.
And then on top of all of that, if Okoro plays to a certain expectation off the bench, like he's two shifts a game, he's able to do what he does best, I'm thinking in my mind, well, I think that slots Austin Reaves permanently and more into a natural shooting guard position. Like, he doesn't have to switch roles all the time. Oh, this is the bench lineup. I'm the point guard. I got to facilitate now. And then flip back when LeBron is in or when Luka is in. Like, where it's role clarity, and it's still the same kind of play with the pick and roll play. Just Luka does it with his, you know, being shifty, shifting his weight, shifting the weight of defenders all over the place, being off-timed, and then he gets a shot in the paint. And then Okoro is just like, well, I will just shake you until you're out of your socks, and I'll be all the way at the rim, and somebody's going to be open because somebody's helping you on the other side. So it's two different versions of getting to the same result. And if you're telling me, hey, this is our three-guard rotation, I'll be like, wow, we've got a really killer set of, you know, people who can drive at the rim. So that's a best-case scenario.
Heck yeah, man. Want to move on to another on-ball player we didn't get a chance to talk about last time, and I've seen his name a couple of times. Dalen Swain, a forward, ball-handling forward, who helped get Texas to the Sweet 16 this past season. Not really a catch-and-shoot guy. Again, you know, had a lot of on-ball reps there, but certainly has that slashing potential, and I don't hate the idea of a wing that has a good deal of experience in this type of role, but just curious your thoughts on him.
So I've ranked him personally high on my board. I think I have him top 20 or top 15, somewhere along those lines. He's an athletic, roughly 6'6 plus, 6'10 wingspan plus, general wing size. But earlier in his collegiate career, I think it was for Providence, he was an off-ball team defender first. So it was like watching a combo forward being switchable and then defensive oriented as an off-ball guy trying to attack the glass, whatever else it might be. It's kind of like a college version of Jared Vanderbilt's role. And then all of a sudden he gets on-ball touches and he's really efficient at the rim. He's actually really efficient from long two range, which makes me optimistic for a shooting overall. But I tend to hesitate when I see guys flip their archetype from, oh, I'm a role player, I'm going to do some dirty work and defend and rebound, to, oh, I'm the number one option on this team.
Right.
And I'm going to attack the defense. I'm going to get my shots. I'm going to set people up, whatever else it might be. And I'm the most efficient guy on my team that can actually do it. So I earned it. I'm skeptical when a guy like that goes to the NBA and then the role is like, hey, we need you to turn down your usage, and we need a little bit of that off-ball cutter, defender kind of guy. And I'm glad your shot has come along. Can you do it by catch and shoot? I'd really appreciate that. Your drives are going to be opportunistic at best. We have creators. Mm-hmm. So that's got to be put on the side. But if he buys into the idea of, oh no, I'm willing to accept that role, and I will do the best that I can as a defender, as a team defender, as a rebounder, whatever else I need to do. But then if there's a bench lineup coming in and you need a creator on the floor, maybe let me show some of my stuff a little bit and then run that side of the offense. And in that case, I still wouldn't have him as a primary. But if you tell me, hey, this is a secondary creator next to Austin on a bench lineup, okay, now it makes a lot more sense to me. A lot of my hesitation is also based on he just really needed to dribble the basketball on the floor. Even when he was open on a catch and shoot, it's like I'm watching the defender close out. And then he still dribbled. He didn't just shoot right away, even though when he was up.
Oh, the Maxwell Lewis, the old Maxwell Lewis, I got a step back on every three I take.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I think the player's just defaulting to what they think they do best.
Of course.
And it's like, I'm going to do a pull-up shot, and it's going to take a few more seconds, but let me get these dribbles in first, and then I'll go pull up because I have my rhythm. And that may not transfer to the next level, and that further affects the catch-and-shoot ability overall. So that's my hesitance, but he's a high-skilled, very athletic, you know, wing-sized player where traditionally in the past I would have absolutely fallen for. So it's just, this is one of those things where it's like, you need the interview process. You know, you need to know if like the coach talked to the player and be like, hey, this is what we're going to expect out of you. Are you okay with that? And if there's any hesitance or whatever else it might be, then you might want to go in a different direction. But in terms of usage and role and all that other stuff, that's where my hesitance lies, but he's a very good player.
Let's go to break here. Come back. I want to talk about a guy who's around his same height, but a little more of a natural catch and shoot player. Mike, Isaiah Evans out of Duke. A little bit on the skinny side. That's one of the things that pops out on the negative for me, but reminds me of another Isaiah Joe out of OKC. A little similar in style, at least from my little blink reaction to him. What do you think about Isaiah Evans?
I'm really glad that he progressed this past year for Duke. One of the things he needed to improve on several things, which included off-ball defense, kind of a general motor defensively as well. And then not just defaulting to taking, you know, tough contested three-point shots, but also attacking the rim opportunistically. I like Isaiah Evans a lot, especially as he's not a fly around the corner Duncan Robinson kind of shooter. I think shooters like that are rare and they have to learn that skill into the NBA. I'm just skeptical because this archetype isn't usually as successful right off the jump as a rookie. It's like, oh, I'm seeing physicality and these screens aren't working and I'm not as open and I was already taking tough shots at the college level and now they're just harder because it's the NBA and I've only got 24 seconds to do it, more like 16 plus. So in contrast, Isaiah Joe was more of a spot-up catch-and-shoot guy and he was a really high-volume guy. It was like, you know, like taking 12 to 15 three-pointers in 40 minutes. Mm. That was his pace of three-point shooting. And then he was just 40% accurate through all that. That was just outlier number. Evans is not that volume, and he was a catch-and-shoot guy whenever he had those opportunities, but a lot of the time, his shots were contested, and then he would still make a few. If you look at his three-point percentage, it's 36%. Well, if you tell me it's 36%, but they're like tough contested shots, I'd be like, great, great that they're contested. Also, on the flip side, like, can you get a little bit more space so they're not contested so
right,
hard?
Right.
Right? So, flip side to the coin. I will say, I mean, he is 6'5 and a half without shoes. He's got 6'8 plus arms. But what surprised me was he has the same standing reach as Joshua Jefferson. So he comes off unusually long. It's 8'8 and a half. So if I'm looking at general archetypes, if I say 8'6 for a shooting guard, that's kind of like a passable number. 8'4 plus for a point guard is really good. 8'8, 8'9 for a three. And then Evans is in that small four range. It's like, well, that's great. Well, can we put him in places where he could be more positive? And it's like, well, at least he's got the length. So he's just going to be like a long rangy two. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, he's still 186 pounds. Akori is roughly the same weight. And I am concerned that physicality is a thing at the next level. I mean, there's no way we can tell how easily guys can just add 10 to 20 pounds. When I'm looking at defenders, I look at the feet. I'm also looking at contact absorbency through the chest. And, you know, that's not going to be as easy for him at the next level.
Yeah, that's my concern is just how he's going to deal with that NBA level physicality. I got one more guy for you, Mike, before another general question. International guard out of Spain, Sergio de la Rea. What do you think of him?
I'm glad I polished up on this yesterday. This is why I haven't been sleeping. So I got all the footage I could get out of Sergio. And off of memory, 6'6 without shoes, 6'9 wingspan, roughly 200, 210 pounds. Let me start with defense. Defensively, he was a little bit heavy-footed laterally, but he kind of knew what he was doing. What I did like was, from the video that I watched, he was able to read the play on the defensive end and kind of like beat his man to the spot. So his man is coming around the screen, and he's going to end up at this spot of the floor, and this is where he gets the ball. Sergio just beats him to the spot. It's like, oh, no, I'm still in your face. I'm not going to sag off a little bit. I'm not going to go too hard and try to steal. I know where you are. That's where I am, too. It's hard to find that kind of general knowledge at this relative age, so that's a good sign. And then on the offensive end, I didn't really see much of a mid-range game at all. And the thing is, I'm always conscious of these bigger guards that aren't aware that they could be super physical if they wanted. Like, you're a wing size guy, right? Dalen Swain, when I watch him attack, he's initiating contact against the defense. He's going right at the rim. And then when it's Sergio, it's like, oh, I'll be a little bit more opportunistic, even though I have the size advantage. I have good athletic ability, but I just want to make sure I got a clean shot at the rim kind of thing. Once again, no mid-range game. And then he was more of a spot-up shooter, not like dribble, dribble, step back, pull up three kind of thing. I did like what I saw, but in terms of future projection, I think there's a little bit more development required for the Lakers to be like, oh, no, that's really our guy. We know what we want out of him.
And then last thing for you, Mike, the idea of trading up or trading down, do you have any strong opinions in either direction?
That's a good question. I would consider trading down if there is at least one late first to early second. When I say early second, it means 33 and earlier, so it's going to be tough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's kind of a big teardrop of talent once you get past number 33. So trading down, okay. If it's trading up, I'm wondering what kind of assets it would take to trade up. Would I trade a future first in order to trade up? No. Those future firsts could be really valuable considering the new odds of how things might work out in the future. And I also think those future picks could be used in a trade that into something more valuable. In general, I'm thinking I'm okay if you trade picks, but get a starter or get a 20-minute guy at the very bare minimum.
Yeah.
If it's one pick, okay, I want basically a sixth or seventh man. If you're trading a future first included in the package, I would like to see a starter. And not just, oh, we signed a guy and he starts for the year and we're not sure about him long-term. It would be nice to have some more permanence at any position outside of the guard rotation. And I know that's not easy to do. And this is why I cover the draft, because those are guaranteed contracts and non-guaranteed contracts and two-way contracts. So that's kind of where I'm at with the spectrum of trading up or trading down. I mean, the guys to trade up for, I mean, there's only the four guys I really like. We haven't talked about Maurice Johnson Jr., but he's also another, you know, borderline small center, proper size center, but high motor guy, plays with a lot of force, everything he does, especially when he hustles and attacks the glass, whatever else it might be, and he has the hint of a shot behind the arc. So if we're trading up for that, then great. And it would also make me think that, yes, we're contending, and maybe the assets that we were looking for aren't there this year, but what we're thinking of within the next 2 or 3 years in terms of creating a team and then actually building chemistry and not having a rotation of guys going on and off the team, this is what we're actually looking for. And I've come to a point where I think I'm okay with that now. We always think of like, oh, I would like a dynasty. I would like a two-peat. I would like a three-peat. And the NBA is just difficult, man. Like the past few years have been single championship teams. And what ends up happening is some team gets hurt. Some guys get let go. Some guys get traded, whatever else it might be. They're still competitive, but it's not the same as the original championship team that was built in the first place. So I'm hoping for a better long-term outlook and plan instead of, oh, we need to get this guy, he can contribute immediately. Well, if you get six guys that contribute immediately and then the year is over and then you can't even keep those guys, it's like, well, there's no really upside to that roster. It's just getting flipped again, right? So it's really tough in terms of roster construction.
I lied, Mike. I got one more for you. One of my favorite things to do when watching the draft is, you know, after a certain point, my favorite memory of this was Nick Van Exel, right? I remember watching Van Exel make a great Final Four run with Cincinnati in 93. And it was like, that guy's awesome. I want him on my team. And he was projected to be like a late lottery, mid-first type of guy. And he just kept dropping and dropping. And the Lakers had the 37th pick. And I remember by like pick 28, I'm going nuts, just like hoping he drops. And I think the Nuggets selected a guy named Darnell Mee with the 36th pick. And I was like, please, please. And then West drafts Van Exel with that pick. It's the 15th pick in the draft. Give me three or four guys, and you've named probably most of them at this point, that you've got your fingers crossed at that point. Just like, fall to 25, fall to 25. It doesn't have to be realistic. I want something to watch for tomorrow night as I'm watching the draft. Give me a list of just a couple of guys that you're like, please, please drop to 25.
Okay, one is Maurice Johnson Jr. He played for Michigan next to Diamara and Axel Lindenborg. That was basically, to me, an all-lottery front court at the college level.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, throughout the season, I thought he was the best prospect of the three and not Axel and not Mara, because ahead of the basketball skills, I'm thinking, oh, this guy's an athlete, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to worry about him getting hurt. he's only in the second year, and he's roughly 250 pounds, and he's got the wingspan, and he finishes with authority, and he's trying to be a perimeter defender as a big, and he looks fine doing that. Like, yeah, this is the guy that I want. Does he need to refine his skills? Absolutely. Does he have the most incredible feel like Joshua Jefferson? No. But that's exactly the guy where it's like, oh, if we do the right things with his development, and I don't have to worry about his physical tools or anything like that, and I know he's got the right mindset for it, that's the guy that I want on my team. And I've heard very impressive things about him throughout the interview process or whatever else it might be from multiple media outlets. So that's one guy. Another one is Cam Carr.
Uh-huh.
Cameron Carr, we spoke about him before. Look, he's 175 pounds. I know we're looking at weight nowadays with these players because of physicality. But if I think you're a tier one athlete,
oh, yeah,
at 6'4 with a 7-foot wingspan, and all you do is shoot threes, but when you do attack, you're just going to dunk on everybody, I will just accept the risk, uh-huh, right? You know, put stakes in the contract, so hopefully the weight gain is actually there too. But as a creator, he didn't seem the most comfortable. The handle needs to be worked on. Some of the passing needs to be worked on. But in my mind, it's this guy isn't a connector. He's a finisher. And when it's finishing, it's high-level finishing. High 30s, low 40% three-point percentage. That's what I would expect. Some pull-up three-point shooting. That's what also I would expect. And above all, it would be, oh, we have a lob threat at shooting guard, and we don't have that currently on the team. And he has so much length with his wingspan and everything else that why don't we just play him at three and just have a speed lineup for a change? So that's two. Okori, mm-hmm, already a rim demon. We've already talked about him before. So yeah, I'm hoping, but I still think he's going to drop, or at least he's the most likely to. And then Quaintance kind of surprises me because he doesn't pass the lens of what Coach Redick is looking for in a triple threat player. Mm-hmm. And then he doesn't pass the lens of, oh, high IQ, high skill, high character. I mean, he's still 18.
Yeah.
It's like he played his freshman year as a 17-year-old, and then he looked like the part.
He looked like a grown-ass man at 17 years old, man. He's a big dude.
I don't use the term man-child often, but I would apply it to him. He doesn't have, like, Sean Kemp's vert or anything like that, but he has grown man strength, and I'm like, you're 17 and you're doing this? Oh, man, that leg's going to heal fast, and you're just Wolverine as an X-Man, and we didn't know about it, right? So those are the four guys I would love to see at 15, hopefully drop to the Lakers. Those are my dream picks that I'm thinking about. If not, I know who I want at 25. I know what it looks like. And I don't really want to trade 25 unless it's the right rotation player, and I'm completely okay with that.
Love it, man. Thank you so much for making this a better experience for everybody. You make the draft a lot more enjoyable. You've got a busy night ahead. Please, everybody, check out his hit over on Trudell and Alan Sliwa's shows. And Mike, thank you so much, man.
Thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, y'all. You've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic got it. Magic fires. It's in. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game.
Rebound to Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel for the winner. It's on the way. Done!
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance.
Right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two. One.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable.
For the victory.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five.
Bryant.
Yeah.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James. putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.